Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Jeff Milchen, director of ReclaimDemocracy.org, who examines the conduct of the Commission on Presidential Debates as this creation of the Democratic and Republican parties works to exclude third-party candidates from participation in future televised debates. Bradley Bridge, an attorney with Philadelphia's Public Defender's Office, who condemns the use of police infiltrators to spy on social justice activists organizing protests at this summer's Republican National Convention. And an excerpt of a speech by Cuban President Fidel Castro, who spoke before a crowd of more than 2,000 supporters at the Riverside Church in Harlem on Friday, September 8th. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The Progressive magazine reports that the Clinton administration is downplaying the recent peace efforts between South Korean President Kim Dae-jung and North Korean leader Kim Jong-il. In mid-June, North and South Korea held a historic summit to warm relations between the often hostile neighbors and to reunify long-separated families. But these moves toward Korean reunification disrupt long-standing U.S. military plans, including deploying a $60 billion national missile defense system. John Isaacs of the Council for a Livable World, a major U.S. arms control group, declares, "North Korea is and has always been the number one excuse behind the missile shield." Chalmers Johnson, author of Blowback, The Cost and Consequences of American Empire, observes, "The Americans have been behaving in a truly surly manner. What they desperately dislike is the peace that has broken out in East Asia." The thaw between North and South Korea has also badly weakened the justification for stationing 37,000 American troops in South Korea. With the growing prospect of Korean reunification, the U.S. recently gave the go-ahead to South Korea to expand the distance of its long-range missiles from 112 miles to 186 miles. So far, South Korea has preferred seeking peace over developing more powerful weaponry. Arms control expert John Isaacs says the U.S. decision to expand firepower in South Korea is crazy, with the current peace efforts gaining steam. Few tourists in Sydney for the Olympic Games will make a stop in Redfern, the urban ghetto home to many Aborigines. The poor neighborhood is full of roofless shacks, homes with dirt floors, and many families stricken by generations of alcohol abuse. Still, according to the World Press Review magazine, there is a much bigger scandal running through Redfern and other Aboriginal communities. Through the 1950s and 1960s, the Aborigines Welfare Board deliberately broke up families with little notice and sent children to orphanages and group homes. An Aboriginal health worker in Redfern, Lola Edwards, was taken from her parents when she was 4 years old. Without any warning, the authorities sent Edwards and her sister to an orphanage. Her brother was sent to a boy's home 110 miles away. "Today," Edwards recalls, "the whole family was spread all over, and my mother and father never were together again." Growing up isolated, Edwards explains that, "I hated my background and the shame of being an Aborigine. I had been brainwashed that we Aborigines were worthless and should forget our culture and our lifestyle." But Edwards' life changed after her brother and sister died of alcoholism. She started Link Up, an Aborigine rights group, to reconnect families who were broken up a generation earlier. Campaigners for Aboriginal rights are prepared to make a lot of noise at the Olympics. Thousands are expected to hit the streets in September during the Games. Protest organizer Jason Field says, "People should know that we are here. We still have a long way to go with our problems, health, education, and rights to land. Only during the Olympics will Australia and the world see how visible we can be." On the coast of Alaska, a yearly herd of more than 130,000 caribou parade through pristine wilderness. This is a place where predators are few, food is plentiful, and their survival is assured. But if Congress, working on behalf of the oil industry, has its way, this Alaskan paradise will be destroyed to provide short-term relief for energy-voracious Americans. As Sierra magazine recently reported, despite oil embargoes and the Gulf War, the U.S. government continues to be oblivious to the idea of energy efficiency. Clinging to the notion that conservation will wreak havoc on our nation's economy, representatives like Michigan Republican Joe Nollenberg have tried to stop government agencies from initiating programs to decrease fuel consumption or educate Americans about the effects of global warming. Energy use in this country climbed 14% in the 1990s, and competition in the oil industry hasn't been this weak since the Standard Oil Trust was broken in 1911. When Asian demand for oil rose and OPEC cut back production, fuel prices skyrocketed in the winter and spring of this year. Congress considered a number of options, like reducing the federal excise tax by 4.5 cents per gallon, but abandoned the notion when it realized oil companies would just keep the increased profits. Another idea was to tap the strategic oil reserves. High profits would be assured for the companies with the guarantee of a long-term customer. That notion was vetoed by the Clinton administration. Finally, it was agreed that the best way to deal with a short-term spike in energy costs is to begin extensive drilling in a remote coastal plain in Alaska. Even if the oil reaches the lower 48 states instead of being sent to Japan, the Arctic Refuge will only supply about 6 months of oil. Sierra concludes with the unhappy speculation that a Bush presidency would virtually guarantee an energy policy based on profits over environmental protection. This week's news summary was compiled by Rich Frazier and Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
The Commission on Presidential Debates, controlled by members of the Democratic and Republican parties, took over the work of organizing televised debates in 1987, when they effectively pushed out the League of Women Voters. The Commission, funded by multinational corporations, unabashedly represents the interests of the two major political parties, a fact which is evident in their setting a 15% threshold of support in selected national opinion polls to qualify third-party candidates to participate in this year's debates. This 15% litmus test has not always been part of the debate rules. Reform Party candidate Ross Perot was included in the 1992 presidential debates, although he had less than 15% support. Perot went on to win 19% of the popular vote. Former pro wrestler Jesse Ventura was included in Minnesota's 1998 gubernatorial debates, having only 10% support. He later moved into the governor's mansion. In the view of many observers, inclusion in televised debates is critical for lesser-known and underfunded candidates to get their message out to voters. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Jeff Milchen, director of ReclaimDemocracy.org, who discusses why he believes there is an urgent need to establish a truly nonpartisan and publicly accountable debate commission.
Now, the Commission on Presidential Debates was created in a joint agreement between the Republican and Democratic parties. The two-party chairs got together and decided that they wanted to create a body that would, in their own words, contribute to presenting joint campaign appearances of the two major parties to the American public. At this time, the two major parties were both exerting a tremendous amount of power over what happened in the debates and trying to control every aspect, right down to camera placement, at which point the League actually withdrew, and they made a powerful statement when they did, saying they refused to be part of, quote, hoodwinking the American public. And from 1988 on, these debates have been sponsored by this commission. And these debates are the only ones that have been broadcast over all of the major networks in the following elections.
As far as the Commission on Presidential Debates itself, does it have any legal standing, legal authority, aside from that invested in it by the two major political parties?
Only the parties and the major broadcast networks and the media. There is no official status whatsoever, despite the official sounding name. The power over whether or not we as people grant them legitimacy is one that they should earn. And after going a little bit more into the depth of the organization, I hope people would choose not to grant them that legitimacy.
Now, as far as Ross Perot, back in, 92, he was part of the debates, and there were record numbers of viewers watching what was, for that time, a very big departure for presidential debates, having a third party involved in them. Tell us a little bit about how that happened and how the Commission on Presidential Debates is currently handling third-party candidates.
Sure. Well, the Commission has changed its criteria each and every election cycle. Now, the Federal Election Commission mandates that objective criteria be met. They also actually mandate that the group sponsoring the elections be nonpartisan in order to be a tax-deductible 501c3 organization, on which the CPD fails both accounts. But going back to your question of 1992, Ross Perot was polling anywhere from 7 to 9% in the week immediately preceding the debates that year. So he would not qualify under what the commission has established this year as their preferred criteria. But as you noted, those three-way debates in 1992 created an incredible amount of interest. They had viewership averaging 90 million for the three broadcast debates. Voting was up 12 million from the preceding election, and that was just a one-time upward trend and otherwise consistent downward slope where we reached an all-time low in the last election of less than half of the American public voting in the presidential election. And comparing that to what happened 4 years later in 1996, when it was a two-way debate, the viewership dropped in half, and again, voter participation took a major nosedive. And that was with Perot, a candidate again in 1996, after having demonstrated huge public support in 92 and getting more than 19% of the popular vote. This commission decided this year we don't consider him an electable candidate and excluded him from the debates, Ross Perot. And not surprisingly, his election numbers plummeted to about 8%. So it's a self-fulfilling prophecy when you give power to a commission to say this candidate is or is not electable and give them the power to hide them from public view.
What are some of your ideas over at ReclaimDemocracy.org for setting up an alternative set of criteria, well, to both constitute a commission that would make these decisions and criteria under which candidates would be selected?
Well, the important thing, I think, is to focus really on the roots of the problem. And unfortunately, we see a lot of groups around the country focusing on petitioning the commission or writing letters or emailing the commission and saying, please change your criteria. Please let this particular candidate into the debates. And that, in our opinion, is a failed strategy. We have an inherently illegitimate corporation controlling a vital democratic process, and we really need to set our sights on the necessary step of completely removing this corrupt commission and instituting a body that can promote the interests of democracy, not a duopoly. So as far as specific criteria, as an organization, we're not promoting a specific set of criteria. We're simply saying that we need to have a democratically accountable body making these decisions. In terms of an opinion, I think starting off with at least one debate that included those six or seven mathematical contenders and having the public get at least one chance to hear those legitimate contenders and then maybe invoking some more stringent criteria to narrow down the field ultimately would be a reasonable set of criteria. We should have the ability to mandate, and we do have the ability to mandate, that broadcast networks broadcast a certain amount of public interest programming, and that should include debates set up under democratically decided criteria that would be an obligation for those networks as a privilege of doing business, not at their whim to decide do they want to favor the group that's presenting the bipartisan debate or favor the groups that are presenting the multipartisan debate.
That was Jeff Milchen, director of ReclaimDemocracy.org. Contact the group by calling area code 303-402-0105 or visit their website at www.reclaimdemocracy.org. According to recently unsealed court documents, four Pennsylvania state troopers were among the dozens of activists building puppets, floats, and props to be used in demonstrations at this summer's Republican National Convention in Philadelphia. The officers, posing as union carpenters, volunteered their services at a warehouse that was later raided by police on August 1st, the same day thousands of protesters engaged in nonviolent civil disobedience to block traffic on city streets. Close to 400 demonstrators were arrested during the actions in Philadelphia, including 75 who were picked up in the warehouse raid. The police infiltrators had stated that protesters in the warehouse were constructing devices to block traffic, an allegation denied by the activists who say they were only making puppets for demonstrations in an art studio. Court documents also state that police believe that funding for the protests came from communist and leftist parties, some allied with groups connected to the former Soviet Union. Police set unprecedented amounts of bail for many of those arrested on misdemeanor charges. Some identified as leaders were held on as much as $1 million bond until the court ordered reductions. Additionally, law enforcement was engaged in monitoring telephones and email communication. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Bradley Bridge, an attorney with Philadelphia's Public Defender's Office, representing some of those arrested, who condemns the use of police infiltrators and Cold War-era propaganda to disrupt and discredit the activities of social justice activists.
The police had obtained a search warrant, and the basis for their search warrant alleged that the warehouse was being used for the production of puppets, but also for the production of lockboxes, which were plastic devices made out of PVC pipe and some chain and some chicken wire that immobilized people's arms. If they would place them in them, they could lie down at an intersection and make it difficult for the police to remove them. And that was the reason for their preemptive raid at the warehouse. And I guess several trucks also. They arrested the people in the trucks allegedly for possession of the same items. The interesting thing is they didn't find anything like that in the warehouse. They supposedly had a number of troopers that had infiltrated it. I think the number I'd heard is about four. And they didn't find any of those devices at all in the warehouse. They found puppets. And I know that's what they found because actually I was in the warehouse at the time.
As an attorney, how do you look at this case in terms of the veracity and the legal grounds under which this raid was conducted?
Well, I guess let me examine each of those two questions separately. If you talk about veracity, there's a lot of questions about the truthfulness of the allegations made in the search warrant. Certain things were alleged there that, from what I've been able to determine so far, are simply incorrect, or maybe outright false. So veracity is called into question. If you talk about the legality of it, there's not a real strong basis, even if you accepted all the allegations as being true in the search warrant, to go in preemptively and arrest 75 people sitting in a warehouse doing nothing but making puppets.
What do you make of the Pennsylvania authorities, both in the city of Philadelphia and the governor's comments, that somehow this was necessary preemptive steps to protect the people of the state of Pennsylvania?
I guess the simple thing is he's obviously doesn't know anything about the facts, because that's not what happened. There were not modest passive steps. There were actually some fairly aggressive, immodest steps. And if he's worried about saying that there's a right to protest and a right for lawful protest, then the people who wanted to make a message and send it out to the community should have been allowed to do so. The people were producing puppets. They weren't actually doing anything else other than producing puppets. And when the police raided the warehouse, that's all they found. And not only did they arrest everybody in the warehouse, but then they threw all the puppets that they found in the warehouse in the garbage. So it's pretty clear that they were not only bent on stifling the people who were making the message, but they were actually bent on stifling the message itself.
I wanted to go over some of the information that was unsealed in these police documents. The documents, according to the Philadelphia Inquirer, they talk about funding for one group allegedly originating with communist and leftist parties and from sympathetic trade unions or from the former Soviet allied World Federation of Trade Unions. That's according to the affidavits recently unsealed. What do you make of this kind of revitalization of the Cold War in Philadelphia?
I think apparently whoever authored the affidavit of probable cause is plainly out of touch with present reality and is stuck back 40 years. It has absolutely nothing to do with the world in which we live in now. It probably had nothing to do with the world we lived in 40 years ago, but it certainly has nothing to do with the world we live in now.
Is this sort of an orchestration, do you think, to sort of taint or otherwise reduce the credibility of the groups organizing the protests that we've seen growing in the last 8 to 10 months?
You know, I think it might have been an attempt to do that, but I think if you look at the allegations, what it does is it really taints the allegations and the alleges themselves. To spout such bizarre paranoia has to strike any intelligent person is as ridiculous and absurd on its face.
What are some of your greatest concerns about where things are headed with local and federal law enforcement as it applies to this new and growing global justice movement?
As I said, I was present when the people went through the warehouse, and I was there when Secret Service went through, and ATF went through, and the bomb squad went through. So it was clear that there was a lot of coordination between the federal, state, and local police forces in that situation. So I think the coordination of the police organizations to thwart a message is exceptionally threatening, because it's not just on one level, but it's all over, and it's a national effort. And I find that tremendously intimidating and daunting. Everyone should be concerned about it, because the threat of any one person to present a lawful message is a threat to everybody's ability to present a lawful message.
That was Bradley Bridge, an attorney with Philadelphia's Public Defender's Office. Contact the Defender's Office by calling area code 215-568-3190. Or to offer support, contact the R2K Legal Collective at 215-704-0911. On Friday, September 8th, Cuban President Fidel Castro spoke before an admiring crowd of more than 2,000 at the Riverside Church in Harlem. Outside were hundreds of others listening via a PA system. In New York, to attend the Millennium Summit at the United Nations, Fidel Castro was accompanied by his translator and Cuba's National Assembly President, Ricardo Alarcón. The U.S. originally denied a visa to Alarcón, but he was allowed entry at the last moment. The Cuban leader spoke for almost 4 hours about the urgent need to abolish world hunger, curable childhood diseases, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa, and the hypocrisy of world powers that reap the benefits from developing nations but do little to assist the downtrodden. Castro even mentioned the infamous handshake between himself and President Clinton, noting that the press focused on that and not the substance of his millennium speech. In closing, Castro spoke about Elian Gonzalez, who he said is back in his modest home with his family in Cardenas. Here we present an excerpt of the speech focusing on world trade.
Cada día.
Every day.
Trillions of dollars.
$3 trillion of dollars involved every day in financial transactions, in speculative operations.
¿Qué tiene que ver esto con el comercio mundial?
What does it have to do with world trade?
Todo el comercio mundial.
Well, all of the world trade.
A 6.5.
Amounts to 6.5
millones de dólares.
Trillion dollars.
Que cada dos días,
it means that every 2 days,
en esas bolsas que ustedes tanto han oído mencionar,
in those stock markets that you hear so much about,
se realizan operaciones especulativas.
Speculative operations are conducted equivalent
a 2 días
to 2 days
del comercio mundial
of all of the world trade
a lo largo de todo el año.
In the course of a whole year.
Cuando nació esa bolsa de que hablé,
when the stock market emerged,
no existían estos fenómenos.
These phenomena did not exist.
Esto es algo totalmente
nuevo. This is something
nuevo,
absolutely new.
Verdaderamente absurdo.
Absolutely absurd.
Las operaciones especulativas.
Were these kinds of speculative operations.
Es un fenómeno.
And that
creciente
is a growing phenomenon
en los últimos 20 años.
In the last 20 years.
Ya el dinero no se emplea en inversiones.
Money is no longer being used in investments.
Fundamentalmente para la producción.
It's no longer being used for the
el
production
dinero se emplea
of goods.
En dinero.
The money is being
moneda
used to produce more money.
En acciones.
To buy stocks in the market,
llamadas derivadas,
to get it involved in the so-called derivatives operations,
que no tienen nada que ver,
which have absolutely nothing to do
con el origen del comercio internacional,
with the origin of trade.
Eso es lo que nos ha traído la cacareada y famosa globalización.
That is what has been brought about by that famous globalization, which is so much discussed.
El dinero buscando desesperadamente el dinero. Con el empleo, los países desarrollados controlan el 97% de todas las patentes del mundo.
Of all of the patents in the world.
Porque naturalmente,
because of course,
los países desarrollados se llevaron todas las inteligencias. Nosotros estamos bien informados.
We are rather well informed
de lo que ocurre en el mundo.
Of what happens in the world.
Porque uno de nuestros principios,
because one of our principles,
es la solidaridad.
Is solidarity.
Para nosotros es uno de los principios más sagrados.
Solidarity is for us one of our most sacred principles.
Los que creen en el hombre,
the people who believe in man,
en la capacidad,
in the capacity of sentiments,
del hombre,
of man's
sentiments, en la capacidad para la bondad,
in man's capacity to be generous,
del hombre,
to be kind. Nobody would understand that we care for those who die and suffer, and that
we would not care. Por el niño haitiano.
For the Haitian children,
Guatemalteco,
for the children from
Dominican,
Guatemala, from the Dominican Republic,
puertorriqueños,
for the Puerto Rican children,
africanos,
for the African children,
o de cualquier otro país del mundo,
for the children of any other country.
Pues no se puede afirmar que la especie humana haya alcanzado su grado más alto de conciencia mientras no sea capaz de experimentar su sufrimiento.
Of suffering what other people suffer.
La humanidad llegará
that, I believe,
al máximo de su conciencia y de sus cualidades potenciales
potential qualities,
cuando a una persona
when
le duela
a person
igual
is hurt,
la muerte
the
del
same
hijo
way for the death
de cualquier familia
of any family's child,
le duela tanto
when that person is hurt for the death of any child's son,
como la muerte de su propio hijo
by the death of his own son or daughter,
o de cualquier otro familiar cercano.
That was Cuban President Fidel Castro speaking at the Riverside Church in Harlem. This segment was recorded and produced by your reporter, Denise Manzari. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced by WPKN Radio's Public Affairs and News Departments. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a cassette copy of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756. Or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Rich Frazier, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.